Welcome to the Today's Leader podcast. Building tomorrow's best leaders, today.
Way to go, guys. Way to go. Keep it going. Good job, guys. All right, Paul. All right, John. Finish off. Coach Carl.
Hey there, it's Coach Curl here and welcome to episode 448 of the Today's Leader podcast, Building Tomorrow's Best Leaders Today. Now, in workplaces, conflict is inevitable. And some would actually say it's necessary if you truly want to achieve your highest performance. But often it's how we react and deal with it that creates pain amongst ourselves and amongst our team. Many leaders dread conflict, and as a consequence of that, they deal with it poorly. Now, today's guest sheds some light for our listening leaders on how conflict management can be effective through strategies, including storytelling. Very interesting, this particular conversation. How can you use storytelling to improve understanding, rapport, and dealing with conflict within your team? Michael McRae is an award-winning writer, storytelling and conflict consultant, trainer and leadership coach. His work explores how storytelling can create change, make meaning and transforms division. I love that, transforms division. He works with organizations right around the world to help them tell their most meaningful stories and navigate through their most difficult conflicts. It's an incredible conversation. And after a word from our sponsor, Think and Grow Business, it's my pleasure to welcome Michael McRae to the Today's Leader podcast.
The podcast is brought to you by Think and Grow Business, the home of the Think and Grow Business Mastermind. If you're serious about growing your business, get serious and join a mastermind group today. Find out more at thinkandgrowbusiness.com.au.
Pleasure to welcome to the Today's Leader podcast, Building Tomorrow's Best Leaders Today, the author of I Am Not Your Enemy, Stories to Transform a Divided World. Please welcome Michael McRae to the podcast. How are you today, Michael?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on.
It's a pleasure, and I'm really intrigued about some of your service offerings, so I'm really excited to have this conversation. But first up, let's just start with a little bit of a story. Tell the audience the Michael McRae story.
Yeah. Well, I come from a very small town in East Tennessee in the United States. We had 2,400 people and two stoplights. It was the kind of place where I could go down the street and ask, get a haircut and tell them my dad would come by after work to pay them. You know, everybody knew the family. My dad was a small town family doctor. Quite a unique place to grow up. But when I was about 12, my dad took a 6-month sabbatical from his work, and we ended up traveling overseas. And so I lived overseas for 6 months and developed this deep fascination with the world and with travel and the stories that are told in different places around the world, and always had this real hunger for stories, a vivid imagination since I was a kid. And so as I got older, when I went to college, I ended up studying history and thinking about the way we tell stories about the past and who gets to tell those stories, how do people show up in them. And also at a very young age, my first international trip had been to the Middle East. And so I got very interested in conflict and how conflicts are resolved, the way that people tell stories in those conflicts about each other, the role that narrative plays in that. And so that has shaped a lot of my path. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by stories as well. Just the other week, I went down to see a guy from a band that I used to love in my youth, you know, so it's a bit long in the tooth. So it was a number of years since I've last seen him perform, and he was performing with his wife, And it was a very small and intimate crowd. And I was just sitting there thinking, look at all the stories in this room, you know, the journeys that people have been on. Some still look like they were in that nightclub 40 years ago. They were dressed in the way that they would dress then. And then you've got other people that were really prim and proper. And I'm just thinking, this is fascinating.
Yeah.
And I would have loved the opportunity to have dissected and asked questions to the crowd. So I think that that's... stories are fascinating. So let's talk a little bit about storytelling. Obviously, that's really, really important for you. Tell me firstly about the book, I'm Not Your Enemy, Stories to Transform a Divided World.
So this book came from a project that I did several years ago where I traveled in Israel, Palestine, Northern Ireland, and South Africa. Basically gathering as many stories as I could of people who had lived their lives in divided societies and we're trying to find another way to live with one another than to pursue vengeance and reciprocity. And so I had all these amazing conversations with former combatants, with people who had been bereaved, people who had survived wars. And kind of the book narrates my conversations with them, looking at themes of forgiveness and reconciliation, trauma, the role that stories play in dealing with division. And so it's the sort of the theme of the book, I guess, is like, how is it that we can get to a place where we can look at somebody and say, I'm not your enemy and you don't have to be mine. And how do we use stories to transform the divisions that we're in? And so for me, the book is in many ways trying to speak to people in the United States where I'm from. But my sense has always been of late that if I were to just try to tell stories about the divisions of the United States, people in the U.S. close up pretty quickly because they begin very quickly populating those stories with all their own, you know, opinions and their own kind of their own relationship to those stories already. But if you can take stories with similar dynamics but put them in unfamiliar contexts, people go into those stories with kind of a fresh position. Their defenses aren't up because they're encountering these stories somewhere else, and then along the way they begin to realize, this is very similar to what is happening back home, and so they kind of come around in the back door, so to speak, on that. So like in literature it's called defamiliarization, the idea of, you know, taking a familiar story and putting it in an unfamiliar context.
Yeah, and in many ways, that's going to remove the perceptions that people have. I mean, we're all telling our own story that we're on the right side of politics or that we're on the good guys or what have you, and everyone else who thinks differently is the enemy or they're evil or they're, you know, worse names. So you get to see so many people getting called names just because of the way they think and act. So I think that that's quite a compelling structure. But so what is it about stories? Why do stories matter in the process? What is it about that draws people into the story?
One of my favorite quotes about stories are that the shortest distance between two people is a story. I don't know if you've heard this quote. Two people is a story. You know it, I think, from experience, that if you're sitting down with somebody and you hear a story, they tell you a personal story that you can connect to, you can feel the gap between you shorten very quickly. And I think that stories matter because through our stories, we can open ourselves with vulnerability to one another, which is the most unique and powerful place for human connection. Stories also have an ability to shape our imaginations and to help us see the world in fresh ways. I believe very definitively that stories affect the breadth of our imagination. So the stories that I tell and the stories that I listen to will inform the way in which I imagine what's possible in the world, right? So as a leader, if I want my team, my organization to grow in a certain way, I need to tell a story that is orienting them toward that new vision, right? A vision story that can point them in that direction. So stories have this this really remarkable ability to orient us in certain directions and to make us feel this deep sense of connection to one another. And so I guess in a sense what I'm saying is like stories help us believe. And stories, you know, when I was a kid, my parents had to really limit whatever movies I would watch because I would immediately go out and try to act them out, right? So like I can remember trying to jump off my rocking horse when I was a kid, trying to see if I could fly like Peter Pan, you know. It was just like, it was very, my imagination was vivid and the stories made me believe, yeah. right? They made me believe yeah. that I could do that. And so I think that what we do with stories is we're trying to create engagement and belief and what yeah. and what we're doing, what our work is, who we are, so that we can get people to take the action that we want. Yeah.
Yeah. I always found that personal connection to be something that we just sort of discount so much in the world, but it's just so powerful. And I remember a story, and I'm probably going to get the finer details of this story wrong, but there was a female black reporter that sort of infiltrated, or didn't infiltrate, but worked with people from who were, you know, predominantly, let's call them the KKK. And after a period of time, and after a period of actually getting to know each other, some of the guys that were very fixed on their ways in regards to race were in tears, because all of a sudden they realized that this was a person. Mm. And they actually got to know the person as opposed to the skin of the person, which is how they were making their judgments. And that story is just so powerful mm-hmm. for me. So that when you do get that personal connection, you can really make a world of difference. So mm-hmm. I'm fascinated by how you use stories with conflict. So we know in our corporate worlds, in the business world, there is always conflict, whether it's an underlying conflict. It's very rare that you would have no conflict or perception of conflict within organizations.
Yeah.
How do we use storytelling to help people with conflict resolution?
Yeah, so there's a couple of ways that I go about it. One is that I don't always just come in straight at conflict and stories. So sometimes yeah. I have to. Sometimes, you know, someone might say, hey, we're actually having a real conflict right now. Can you come and help us mediate that? In which case, you know, then part of the way in which I would structure the mediation would be to kind of pull at the threads of the stories that they're telling, you know. That would be a very direct way of just saying, tell me the story of what's happened, and we would engage it that way. But usually it's kind of working on teaching skills and mindset shifts that can really help with understanding conflict. So one of my workshops that I teach, so I do a lot of training. So one of the workshops I do is called Learning the Language of Conflict and Emotions. And so I work with folks to understand a diagram within conflict called the Penn diagram. It's like this pyramid. And at the top of the pyramid are positions, the middle level are interest, and the bottom level of the pyramid is needs. And the idea is that in conflict, we pretty much always argue our positions, much like my two-year-old does with me. Hey, Dad, I want to throw my oatmeal across the table. You're not going to do that. Yes, I am. And that's the way we still do conflict. Nothing ever changes when we do that. If we can get down to the level of the needs, what are the needs and the interests, the wants, the desires that are driving our positions? That's where we can actually have some movement within conflict. And that's where stories lie, right? So we can get to, tell me about what's driving this. You know, why is it that this feels so important to you? And you can begin to invite those stories, not to say, it's not so much that I'm interested in your beliefs about why this is important, but where does this connect to something personal in your life that's giving you such a strong emotional reaction to this? So we would work on things like that, where we would practice identifying some needs underneath positions. We would think through some of the recent conflicts that we would have, and we would identify the needs underneath that and work on how would I tell a story about that. And another process that I do is called a story exchange, where it's focused on building empathy. And so the idea would be that I would get a group of people who are in my training together. Mm. I would pair them up. Ask them to tell one another a true story from their life based on some kind of prompt. And they would have to listen to one another so deeply that what they're going to have to do is sit back in the circle with everyone else and retell their partner's story as if their partner's story happened to them in first person pronouns. Right? If you were to tell my story, you would listen to it, but then to everyone else in the group, you would say, hi, my name is Michael McRae, and I'm a consultant for the United States. Right? You would do the whole thing in first person. And it is a remarkable process to see people taking on each other's stories and have this deep, visceral experience of empathy. And so they're not, when they're doing this, they're not in deep conflict with each other now. So it's not like we're doing direct conflict work, but it's preparatory work, right? It's flexing the muscles of empathy that they're going to need when they get into those conflicts to say, conflict is far more likely to go smoothly and to be resolved effectively when you can have the capacity to imagine the other's point of view. It's going to help you with negotiation. It's going to help you with your with the transformation of the conflict.
Yeah. It's going to give such a broader understanding, I guess, of where their thoughts and perceptions and their own story comes from by having that story and being able to live that story for such a period of time. I mean, admittedly, it's a conversation, it's a statement, it's a story being shared. But you're that story for that period of time. So that understanding, that empathy is really, really strong. It's with Patrick Lencioni's Five Dysfunctions of Team, one of the things in the first things you do in a workshop, or one of the first suggestions, is to get people to share a story from their youth. You know, and you leave it as a pretty general sort of a thing. But it's incredible what people share within that. Some would be something as simple as, I fell off a pony when I was at a 5 year old, when I was five, and I fell off a pony and I've never been on a horse again and I've been fearful of. And then others go really deep because that's the story that they want to share. And it really helps people understand each other. And also build connection with each other, because all of a sudden there's things being shared that, oh, that happened to me, or I live close to there, and did you, so it's incredible.
Two of the practices I do at the start of, I often will do at the start of workshops, one is the old two truths and a lie, right? So I give people, they have to tell me two true statements, and then one that's a lie, and I have to figure, and the group has to figure out which one. And inevitably, whenever you do that, whenever people guess the lie, the person, you know, who told that ends up telling you what the true story was. They're like, yeah, that part was a lie. Here's what really happened. And so you end up hearing the stories anyway. And the other one that I do is basically like show and tell. So I would say, hey, when you all come in tomorrow, bring an object of significance with you. Something that from your house, it could be a picture on your phone, anything that something that you care about, and be ready in about 2 minutes to tell us the story of why that thing matters to you. And so you get to see like all these different objects and learn amazing things about people's lives. And sometimes they're really funny. Sometimes they're quite sincere and meaningful. And so it's another great way to get into those conversations.
Excellent. So you've been in some pretty dodgy places, I guess. What I would consider dodgy places, Middle East and whatnot. They're not the pinnacle of world peace in some of the areas that you've been. So how did that shape what it is that you do, and how do you use those experiences in the work that you do today?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I do is entirely influenced by those experiences from my first trip over to Israel in the West Bank when I was 10, and I ended up doing grad school in Northern Ireland. I lived in Belfast to study conflict resolution. And then spent some time in Rwanda and South Africa, and then years volunteering in U.S. prisons as well. And so there was so much, all of those things, one, got me deeply interested in the experience of conflict and the possibility that conflict can be an opportunity for growth, right? For improvement. Conflict is inevitable. Where two or more people are gathered, there's conflict. There's conflict in nature all the time. It's necessary for improvement, for growth, for progress. And the key is not to eliminate conflict. It's to try to eliminate violent conflict, destructive conflict. So how do we harness the power of conflict to help us? So that has been a very fascinating question for me. For lots of personal reasons, I think that go back to my childhood, including just the fact that I was a middle child. And so I found myself often in the middle of people's conflicts with my siblings or, you know, my siblings and my parents. And so it was just part of who I was, I think. But those experiences in the Middle East, I mean, part of what it led me to see is this the power of empathy, the way in which the amount of people that I spoke to in those countries who had relationships with people that had harmed them. You know, in Rwanda, people who had actually survived genocide and, you know, living next to the people that that tried to perpetuate that genocide on them. And when you ask them how, you know, one of the first things that you often hear is, when I learned kind of what their story was, I was able to understand it in a different way. I didn't excuse it, didn't justify it, but I was able to understand it, that there was there was something very powerful about the about listening, active listening to somebody else's experience and trying to say, what, how would I have responded if I had had a similar experience myself? And so that that power of story, the power of empathy, the power of humility and curiosity, these things that I've never seen someone transform their relationship to an enemy, to someone they're in conflict with, without the practice of humility, of wondering, have I ever, has it occurred to me that I might be wrong about what I thought about them? And the practice of curiosity and wonder, like that I have to actually have, I need to have questions that I want to know. I need to be open to the fact that I could be wrong and then go seeking the information that I need. I need to be looking for that story. So I think those things that I picked up from these travels around the world have entirely influenced the way that I work with leaders in their conflict scenarios in their jobs.
And just that concept of asking yourself the question, could I be wrong about this, is just something that I wish more people would do. What if I was wrong? What if I've been saying the wrong things or thinking the wrong things or backing the wrong horse or whatever the case may be? But that's probably one of the toughest questions anyone's got to ask of themselves.
Absolutely.
What if, could that be true? And it's really interesting. So as I mentioned earlier, storytelling is such a thing that leaders are told often. We have to use storytelling. It's going to inspire people. It's going to build the brand. You know, young entrepreneurs are in their startups and they're trying to share stories and tell stories. And, you know, just the fact that our social media now have this proliferation of what they call the story, story is so vital, but we still get it wrong. So what are leaders getting wrong in relation to storytelling?
Well, one of the big things I think is that they tend to confuse their message or their mission with their story. And so, like, so I was cooking pasta the other day and I saw this, my pasta box, and it said our story on the back. I was like, oh, this should be interesting. And so I looked at the story and it was something like, you know, we've been making this pasta since the 1940s in Italy. We only use the freshest ingredients. You know, we always, and it just was describing their process. And I was like, interesting, not a story. Like, that's not a story. You know, stories are things that happen. Stories, you know, and kind of shorthand have a challenge that we're facing, choices that we make in the face of those challenges, and the outcomes of that, right? So if there's nothing that's happening and unfolding, I don't have a story. And it's not that describing your process is uninteresting. Like, it is interesting, but it's not a story. And so you're missing out on some real power and impact in your communication without getting really clear about what a story is. Because stories are hardwired in the brain for us to respond. Because from an evolutionary need, we learned 10,000 years ago that when a story is being told, it might have information in there that's going to keep us alive, right? Those earliest stories are like, hey, you know those yellow berries over in the field there? Well, Joe ate them and it did not work out for him. Do not eat the yellow berry, right? Like, so there was this sense of the story was the way we developed a capacity to help each other navigate the world by living vicariously through each other's experiences. And so we're always subconsciously listening to a story, wondering what in this is going to help me navigate the world. And so there's this immediate innate kind of capacity of the brain to hook on to a story, you know, where you just like, you can't look away. You got to listen. And so harnessing, knowing how to build a story so that it taps into that is a really important practice. And so, you know, trying, and so with that, I think in confusing the message and the story, the other thing that leaders often do is they go too big. They think that Well, you know, let me tell the organization story. And so, you know, I'll be like, you know, the Amazon was founded, but, you know, you kind of go like, it's real big, but nobody connects to an institution. Nobody develops empathy for an organization. You connect to people, right? To individuals. So how can you center people, even in the story that you're telling about your organization? And so I tell people a lot to remember that summary is not a story. You know, the story is in the specifics. You've got to give the details, not overload it with the details, but you've got to bring us into the moment. We've got to be able to see it in our minds. And if you stay 30,000 feet up, we're not going to be able to connect that. And then you've lost a real opportunity to create engagement with your audience.
Excellent. Excellent. I was once given a tip in relation to public speaking, and I've never really used it myself, but this person was swear black and blue that the best way to start a public presentation, a public speech, is to simply start with the words "once upon a time," because then we know we've got a story coming and it sort of tunes people in. So I'm sort of fascinated by that. And when you were talking about the corporate institution, I used to work with Bunnings Bunnings Warehouse over here in Australia, and they're modelled on the Home Depot philosophy. And as we know, there's two key gentlemen there that started Home Depot. But the Bunnings Warehouse story always starts with Robert and Arthur Bunnings, the brother that started the business in a little hardware store in downtown Perth, Australia, sort of thing. So that connection back to that pioneering spirit, I guess, in so many ways, in 1868 or whatever the time was. So that's part of the story of Bunnings. Everyone gets that story the minute they start the business, because, you know, a big hardware shed is probably hard to build a connection with, but where you know where the foundations of that business came from, you start at,
So there's a glasses company here called Warby Parker, and they send out, you know, you can basically order glasses online, you get them shipped to your home. They're good quality glasses, but not expensive. So when you get a Warby Parker glasses case, they have in there your lens cleaner, which is, and they, on that lens cleaner, they have a 100 word story of Warby Parker. So here, I'll give this as an example. Wow. So once upon a time, a young man left his glasses on an airplane. He tried to buy new glasses, but buying stylish glasses are expensive. Why is it so hard to buy stylish glasses without spending a fortune on them, he wondered. He returned to school and told his friends, "We should start a company to sell amazing glasses for non-insane prices. We should make shopping glasses fun," said another. "We should distribute a pair of glasses to someone in need for every pair sold," said a third. Eureka, Warby Parker was born. Right? So I love that. And it says at the bottom, you've just read our whole story and the amount of time it takes you to eat six baby carrots at a responsible chewing pace. You know, like, so they've got a bit of humor, which makes you feel connected. And it takes you into a moment where you learn a bit about their values and why they created what they did. And it's on a product that everybody who buys their glasses is going to need, you know, so really ingenious marketing and a way to get out your message.
Absolutely. That's fantastic. So I'm going to throw you on the spot a little bit here, and I'm going to talk about change process in businesses and organizations. And, you know, I've read stats that give us varying degrees of success. And I think most corporate CEOs would probably agree that whenever there's a change management process, it's successful to about maybe 65% effective to what the CEO or the change management committee envisaged at the beginning. There's always challenges with the change process. How do we use storytelling with that?
Yeah. So one of the, I think there are three really important stories to tell when we're dealing in times of change. And, you know, I think of the biological principle of heliotropism, the idea that plants grow toward the sun. You know, that if you put a plant in a house, it's going to start bending its way toward the window. And so organizations are very similar. They will grow toward the stories that you put in front of them. So you want to put the kind of light filled stories in front of people. So thinking very carefully about the stories that we tell. And David Cooper, writer in Appreciative Inquiry, talks about three things that people need in organizations in times of change. He says they need novelty. They need to know what's the new that's coming. You know, what's the What's the fresh thing that we're working toward? This is the actual change itself.
Yeah.
Continuity, what's the thing that's going to stay the same? Like, what? Where's our anchor? What's going to hold us fast as we go through the change? And then transition, what is the actual process going to feel like and look like? And so I think there are stories that you can use for each of those to tell the novelty story, which might be a vision story that you pull from somewhere else, you know? So if I'm working with a tech company in Silicon Valley where I live, they might say, you know, over at Google, they already have this thing. Let me tell you about what they're doing over there. And you can tell them about what this thing is at a competitor and be able to say, oh, imagine if we had that here. That's what we're going for, right? So you create a vision story that shows them the new. Then you can have a continuity story, which can be something like it's often a value story, or sometimes they call it, it was true at the beginning, you know, to say, look, at the beginning of our organization, let me tell you what we were like then. And to be able to say, this is always going to stay the same. We're not going to compromise our values, even as we're moving into this new place. So give people a sense of the continuity. And then in the transition stories, I find those are really effective when you can give very specific examples of the behavior that you want modeled in this transition process, to basically show people we've done change before. We've done these hard navigations before and we've made it through, you know, to say, so I remember our sales team, y'all remember the sales team a few years ago when we went through this transition and how they ended up, you know, really joining together. And you kind of, you paint this picture, a specific picture of, and of this behavior to say, we're really looking for this kind of collaboration. And I think if we do that, we're going to be able to get to the, you know, the new that we're looking for.
Excellent.
So continuity, novelty, transition, being able to tell a good, powerful 2-minute story about each of those, I think it's going to be a really helpful practice in navigating change.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes just sense. It just, I'm sitting here thinking, why don't they do that? Why didn't I know that?
And, yeah.
But I guess when you dive into the power of storytelling, it's amazing what you learn, and the concept of being curious and the concept of tuning your people into that curiosity, I think is one of the critical things. So, Michael, that's incredibly fascinating. So I'm going to just ask you some personal questions now as we wind down through the remainder of the interview. So first thing is, who's inspired you in your leadership?
Probably my dad. My dad has been a leader at every place he's ever worked. So he comes in as a family practice doctor and very quickly is asked to run the clinic or be the CEO of the hospital. Or so he has this leadership way about him where he has a vision, but he has an accessibility and approachability that people feel like he takes them seriously, that he is he's sincere and empathic. He's not a he does not ignore the lower workers in pursuit of the profit. He's always worked for nonprofits, and so he's always had this respectability to him that I've really admired in the way that he leads.
Excellent. You've mentioned a couple of traits there. What are the other traits that you would see if leaders want to make an impact today? What are some of those characteristics or traits that they need to have to be the best leader they can be?
I mean, to go back to one from before, just to reemphasize the power of humility, I think leaders so often feel like they need to present themselves as, I know what we're doing, I have it all worked out. And certainly a degree of confidence is helpful. Yeah. But to be able to say, you know what, I haven't always gotten this right. Let me tell you about a time that I didn't get it right. In fact, you know, this is, I call this the failure is our asset story. You know, the, you know, sometimes failure actually proves to be quite an asset. And how can you use that as a story to tell that will show people, I wasn't born knowing these things. I've had to learn this the hard way. And let me tell you what it looked like when I got it wrong. But here's why I think that's actually going to help us now. So the power of humility is one that I see so infrequently in leaders now that it can be difficult sometimes to be around leaders that I work with, because I'm just like, you present yourself as just that everything that you're doing and saying is correct without any doubt in your mind. And nobody in the world is that correct. And so we all know it's a performance. And so you don't take it seriously and you begin to be suspicious of people who present themselves that way. And so practicing humility is a really important one.
And the number one drama that those leaders actually face is that often the people that they lead know that they don't have all the answers, or know that it's full of, the old proverbial. I sort of call that style of leader a bit of bluster and BS. So that's the style, because they're going to get their way through and they're going to make it look like they know what they're doing, but ultimately they don't. And they can be incredibly dangerous for organizations. It gives people a false sense of confidence, potentially the ones higher up, who are looking at someone who's got that confidence, and they think, yeah, that guy's or that girl's switched on and they're ready to go. And they're just not. And just that ability to be, to accept the fact that, hey, I don't necessarily know anything. One of the best leadership lessons I ever had was when I was working with Kmart over here in Australia, and one of the leaders that came into a new store, and he was sharing what he did when he moved into new stores. And one of the first things that he would say in a general meeting is, I don't have all the answers, but together we will. And it's just really stuck with me that you're sitting there talking with a team of 100 employees who are looking at the manager as if, man, you're going to lead us well and what have you. And he says, I don't have all the answers. Together we will. And I think that's just simply powerful. So tell me about your relationship with
family. Yeah, it's... It's a long one with lots of meetings, I don't always do failure well. So there's a way of understanding personalities and motivations called the Enneagram. And I'm a 3 on the Enneagram, which means that my deepest wiring is for success. And I'm often called the Achiever. Yeah. That's the name of the 3. So failure feels like the worst enemy. So it takes a lot of intention to remind myself that there is learning here. And I need to regroup and then do a nice analysis of what was it that didn't work? Where did I get off the path that I thought I was on? But for a lot of my life, especially as a kid, and into college and early adulthood, failure felt like it felt like the real end, as opposed to a new beginning of a more precise and a more clarified path. So it's a very ongoing developing relationship of where I'm trying to become a bit friendlier with failure. But some days are better than others.
Yeah, but it's... once again, failure's got so many mixed messages out there. People say we should embrace it. I haven't met anyone that sets out to fail. And it's always, it's how do we learn from that and how do we move on really, really quickly? Because I just feel like kicking a can down the street. So it's that real balancing act. And I think there's always a lesson in what we may perceive to be failure. So I think that's really important. So out of everything, Michael, that you've done, what's... that you've accomplished, what are you most proud of?
Well, my son, I think I'll say that. I have a 2-year-old son, and I've done a lot of work on myself and understanding the emotional intelligence, language of emotions, dealing with conflict, all these things, and I can see that paying off as I'm raising my kid. I think what I feel most proud of is the reflections that I hear from people when I work with them, when they talk about one, just like how this, the thing that we're talking about, conflict or storytelling, always felt so confusing to them, but that they feel like it's accessible and they're feeling motivated after engagement with me, and that they feel like what I've been working with them on isn't just for their work, that this is something that can enrich their lives in general. And so I remember when I was 14 and I was talking to my mom about something I had learned in a textbook in high school. And she told me, she said, I really think you could be a teacher because you have a really good ability to communicate complex ideas really simply. And I've held on to that. And so I think that's what I feel most proud of when I'm doing my work, to be like, you know what, I made that really clear for someone for whom it wasn't clear, and that's going to help them in both their work and their personal lives. So I think that's what I feel good about.
So what's the vision for you moving
forward? It's a bit open at the moment. I'm just really beginning to develop this consultancy in the way that it is now. It has been sort of a part-time thing for a long time because I was a little bit afraid to just dive in full, but the pandemic forced my hand and I said, okay, we're just going to try this out. And so far it's working great. And so my vision for now is to continue to try to grow my awareness, which is why I'm doing podcasts, things like that, so that people, my sense is that doing storytelling and conflict consulting is a fairly unique thing in this way. And so I don't think I'll be hurting for opportunities unless people don't know that I exist, right? So that's the thing now is what I'm focused on is how do I raise the awareness of what I'm offering so that I can work with folks. And what I'm most passionate about is working with people that are in the area of social change, that are really trying to improve the world, not just making as much profit as possible. And, you know, sometimes the corporations will help pay the bills. But where my passion is how are we using our work to actually improve the world so it's a better place for people to live?
Yeah. Excellent.
My website, michaelmcray.com. That's MCRAY. And if you go to michaelmcray.com/free, FREE, then you'll be able to enroll in a free mini course that I have on the 4 mistakes leaders often make when telling stories. So if you'd like to get access to this free e-course, then just go to michaelmcray.com/free and it'll be delivered right to your inbox.
Yeah. Excellent. That's fantastic. I'll make sure those links are in the show notes. Michael, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. And thank you for investing today's leaders. If you're looking to build better leadership skills, check out the Today's Leader website at todaysleader.com.au. We really are driving a leadership revolution to build tomorrow's best leaders today. Today's Leader is a collective, the mindset to make a difference, the ability to create an impact. Think and Grow Business hosts our Today's Leader Mastermind, Think and Grow Business, where we focus on personal, professional, and business growth. Book your free 30-minute discovery call right from the homepage at thinkandgrowbusiness.com.au. Don't forget, wherever you are standing stronger, braver, and wiser. Don't forget the golden rule. Don't be an arsehole. I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.